Well, today we're kind of going to do a change of pace. So whereas before we were talking about purely theoretical stuff, today and tomorrow we're going to be discussing a couple of different ways that people are actually building quantum computers. So it's a bit closer to the experiments. Okay, so the first question that you need to answer when you think about building a quantum computer is, what are my goals, right? So in particular, what kinds of systems should I be looking at to make a good candidate for building a quantum computer? What properties am I need to, what capabilities am I going to need to have in order to build a quantum computer? And so this is usually encoded using the DiVincenzo criteria. So David DiVincenzo wrote down a list of desiderata for a system to make a good quantum computer, a list of these capabilities. Now, I should say that these criteria are not actually, most of them, strictly necessary, nor are they actually sufficient. So you need some additional properties to really build a big quantum computer. But they are definitely a good starting point and give you a good guidance for what you should be looking for. So the first one is you want a scalable physical system with well-characterized qubits. So what this means is that your system should have kind of discrete and well-defined qubits, and moreover, that you know the capability, know the properties of those individual qubits, which means it has to be kind of under your control, or at least something that you can measure. And when we look at actual examples of how you build it, maybe these will become more evident exactly what they mean. So two, the ability to initialize the state of the qubits to a simple fiducial state, so you need to be able to start off your computer. You need to put it in, say, the all zero state to begin with. Three is long relevant decoherence times. Much longer than the gate operation time. So this is, of course, what makes it a quantum computer rather than a classical computer. You need to be able to create superpositions and have them persist for a long time. And then, of course, in order to do computation, you need a universal set of quantum gates. And finally, you would like a qubit specific measurement capability. Okay, so at the end of the computation, you want to be able to measure the qubits and find out the answer. So one thing that's in this that you can immediately see is not 100% essential is this is asking for the ability to measure individual qubits. right? Whereas, for instance, it would be sufficient in general if you just could measure all the qubits at once. Now, this is maybe saying a little bit more than that, that measuring all qubits at once, you would want to get the answers from all of them separately. And so it's still specific in that sense. But you don't want to have a system where you're kind of only getting the average value of over all the qubits, which is also a very normal thing to do, right? Because individual atoms, they're not going to have too much signal. And it's much easier to get the average than the individual ones. So anyway, so these are the criteria that David DiVincenzo proposed for building a quantum computer. And then later on, he added two more that are kind of relevant if you want to do quantum communications, or if you want to interface your computer with a quantum communication system. So those are the ability to interconvert between stationary and flying qubits, so by a flying qubit, he means one that is kind of naturally going from one place to another, like a photon. Whereas a stationary qubit might be an atom that kind of sits in one place. There's no absolute rule that says your computational qubits have to be stationary and your communication ones have to be flying, but certainly that's kind of the more natural way to do it. And so this condition is just saying that you can switch back and forth between them. That's if you want to interface your computer with a communications device. And then finally, to actually do the communication, you need the ability to faithfully transmit flying qubits between specified locations. And so this one is usually achieved by using photons, because you know, you can put them through optical fibers, you can send them through open air, and they can get from one place to another with pretty high fidelity. Okay? So any questions so far? I turn this on. Okay, so in that case, let's look at one of the leading contenders for building quantum computers today, and that's the ion trap quantum computer. And we'll see how these ion traps kind of realize the conditions 1 through 5. So the basic idea of an ion trap is we're going to use as qubits individual atoms. So one qubit is an atom, usually a group 2 atom, meaning it's from the second column of the periodic table. And that means that it has 2 electrons in its outer shell, right? And we're going to strip away one of those electrons. So now we have an atom with charge +1 and 1 electron in its outer shell. Okay, and this outer shell electron will have many possible energy levels. Basically, we're going to ignore the other electrons. They kind of stay put through our computation. And it's only the outer shell electron that's going to act as our qubit. So we're going to pick out 2 energy levels in particular to serve as our computational states. There's going to be the ground state, G, which is going to be R0. and some excited state. E, which is going to be the one. And so we want to pick these particular states. Well, there's a bunch of factors that go into picking these states. But one of the main ones is, well, the ground state is going to be stable, of course, against relaxation, right? It's not going to get any lower than that. The excited state won't be, necessarily. So we want to pick an excited state that has a very long lifetime, so that if we put the electron in this excited state, it's not going to relax back down to the ground state, except after a very long time. Okay. The other factors are we're actually going to need some additional energy levels, as you'll see over the description of how we do these things. And you want the transitions between these various things to be at frequencies that are accessible by useful lasers that you have, very high quality lasers for them. There's some stability issues against perturbations, magnetic fields, stuff like that. So there's a bunch of factors that go into choosing not just the exact atom, but also the states that you want to use. But for the moment, let's just focus on these two energy levels. So need a new board yet. So the basic system that we're going to be considering is Hamiltonian, which is of course the atom Hamiltonian, concentrating on just this outer shell electron, and really just concentrating on these two energy levels, plus the Hamiltonian of the laser that we're going to use to control things. And actually, there's going to be multiple lasers, but we're going to start out with just one. So the atom Hamiltonian, we can assume the ground state energy is zero. So the atom Hamiltonian is just this. Okay? And then the laser Hamiltonian, well, I'm not going to write it down exactly. There's the Hamiltonian of the laser itself, which we're really treating as basically a classical object. What we're interested in, though, is the interaction of the laser with the electron energy levels. And in particular, it can excite transitions. So we're going to focus on a laser that has frequency omega. And we want this frequency to be resonant to this transition. So omega is going to have the frequency E over H bar. Okay? And then via some approximations, you can get that the laser induces a coupling between E and G with a Hamiltonian of the following form. Okay, so it induces a transition between E and G, and of course back from E to G. Sorry, this is E to G, and this is back from G to E. Okay? So now this J is something that we basically control, right? But mostly we're going to focus on J turning the laser on or off. So it'll go from 0 to this value J. When it's 0, we just have this. When it's on, we have this. Okay? And so when it's 0, the electron stays in G or it stays in E. Those are eigenstates. And when the laser is on, we're going to get some cycling between G and E. And in particular, in the ideal case, when the laser is on, So, for instance, the ground state would go to some superposition. Of G and E, okay? But as time goes past, it'll then go back, right? So you'll get, so you get some oscillation. Yeah, so what I'm gonna plot here is the probability of G over time. This is time. And so, maybe you start at 1 and then you go down to 0, but then it comes back up to 1 again. I need more. More space here. And then it goes down to 0 again and up again and 0, sorry, 0 again and up again and so on. Okay? So it goes back and forth. And this is called a Rabi oscillation. But that's only in the ideal case, right? So in the real world, there's other stuff going on. This is not the full story of the Hamiltonian. And so, for instance, there might be a coupling between this atom and the environment. And the environment is maybe constantly gaining a little bit of information about what energy level the electron is in. That's one thing that could go wrong. So what happens if, say, partway through, the environment makes a measurement? Well, we'll get, say we're up here. So with some relatively high probability in this particular time, we'll get that the electron is in the state G. But with some probability, it will be E, right? So what we have now is a mixed state between G and E. We haven't observed it. The environment observed it. We don't know which one it collapsed to. So it's a mixture now of mostly G with a little bit of E. But then the oscillation continues. So if it was G, well, it continues to oscillate. Well, it kind of gets set back up to here. But if it's E, it's oscillating the opposite direction. And so what we'll see is a similar oscillation, but with lower amplitude, because we'll never have 100% probability of G anymore, right? Because, you know, there's if this was, you know, 75% G and 25% E, then 25% of the time it's always going to be opposite any particular value, right? The most likely value. So we'll get an oscillation with lower frequency. And of course, what's really happening in the system is not, you know, at some particular time the environment decides to measure. Rather, it's continuously gaining information over time, doing some sort of weak measurement. And so what you really get is something that looks like this. So it starts off at 1, and then you get an oscillation, but it doesn't go all the way to 0. And then it comes back, but not all the way to 1. And you lose the fringe visibility over time. These oscillations get smaller and smaller. And eventually it kind of asymptotes to 1/2, to very close to 1/2. And so this kind of the rate at which this envelope of the oscillations decreases is a measure of the decoherence time. In the ion trap, well, the reason that they're a good candidate, one of the main reasons they're a good candidate for quantum computing, is that the atoms are actually really, really well insulated from the environment around them, right? They're in a vacuum, and just you have these atoms held in a magnetic bottle. I guess I didn't really say anything about how they're confined, but they're charged. You know, they have a dipole, so you can trap them with electromagnetic fields. There's a couple of different ways to do that, so there's nothing else around for them to interact with, really. But there is still some decoherence. You know, there's fluctuating electromagnetic fields in the system. There maybe is occasionally a stray photon or atom that's passing by, something like that. So you do see some decoherence. nothing's going to be perfect in the world. But it doesn't look like this. Instead, it looks almost like this for many, many cycles. You can get 10 to the 4 or more oscillations, depending on your parameters, before you start to see kind of appreciable decay of the fringes. Okay? And this is kind of your gate time, as we'll see in a minute. So this is telling us that you really have very low decoherence rate in these systems, and in particular that the decoherence time is in fact much longer than your gate operation time. Okay, so so that's kind of the criterion 3 is satisfied for ion traps.
How much time is this usually?
How much time? Let me think. So I think for ion traps, typical lifetimes is like maybe milliseconds, I want to say. It might be more than that.
So if I take an old book, I would still say this number, or is this like state of the art?
Well, yeah, so this, like I said, it depends on the parameters that you're setting. And there's a lot of different parameters here. I mean, so the rate of this depends on J, which is how much laser energy you want to put in. And it depends on, lots of stuff about the atom and other stuff about the trap. So it depends how old you're looking, I think. But basically, yeah, I mean, this aspect of the ion trap was pretty well under control already 20 plus years ago. And I should say that one of the reasons that ion traps were initially chosen as a good candidate for quantum computing is that the same technology, basically exactly the same technology, can be used to build atomic clocks. And so people had kind of mastered this, the single atom ion trap for that purpose. And for that, you need basically to do this. You need to do the Rabi oscillation experiment for a very, very long time. So you want to minimize decoherence for that, and people had kind of gotten that under control. Now, there's other types of imperfections that occur in the ion trap that were not at that point under control. And that's stuff that's happened over the subsequent decades of people getting better and better at that.
After you turn off the laser, do you have more time or until decoherence, or is it
Yes and no. I mean, I think so this is dependent on how strong a field you want to put in. Right? So if you put a very strong field, then you're gonna get problems because you get kind of excess light and you get two photon effects and you'll get scattering of light and stuff like that. So that kind of limits how big a J you want to put on. But if you don't put on too big a J, I think this decoherence is most in that we're talking about right now is mostly not changed by the presence of the laser. I'm not an expert at this at all, so I could be wrong about that. But I think mostly you want to work in a regime where that's true. Now one thing that's definitely true. Well, let me get back to that in a second. But are there questions on this? Okay. So this is kind of telling you that this is a good system with low decoherence rates. But now we want to be able to actually control it. And in fact, this same type of Rabi oscillation experiment immediately, you can see, gives you a way to control it, right? Because suppose you have, a basis state, E or G, and you want to switch it. You want to do a flip to the other one. Well, what do? You turn on a laser, and you wait for half a cycle, right? So we can characterize laser pulses by the angle that they go through here in this cosine. And so a pi over 2 pulse does a bit flip. Right? It takes us from ground to excited and from excited to ground. Moreover, a pi over 4 pulse, so if you do it for half that time, well then you're starting in 1, but you're ending halfway down here in a superposition of ground and excited. So that's basically doing a Hadamard transform. Okay? And you can do any time in between, right? If you want to do a different single qubit gate. I just want to note at this point that if you do a pi pulse, so this angle is pi, you're actually getting minus ground back. Which doesn't really matter at this point. That's just a global phase. But it will actually be important later on. OK, so that's one set of single qubit gates. We can do the superposition gates that take us from ground to some superposition of ground plus excited. So that's good. But it's not all single qubit gates, right? We also need some other ones. Sorry. Before I do that. So there is one aspect of the laser that creates additional error, definitely. Which is a significant thing, which is suppose you want to do, say, this bit flip gate, right? In order to do it perfectly, you have to do it for exactly the right amount of time, right? If you stop too soon or too late, you're going to do a little bit less than a bit flip or a little bit more than a bit flip. Okay, so there's a timing issue there, and that shows up again in this next set of gates. Now let's think about doing a phase gate. So it's something diagonal of this form. Well, how do we do that? Actually, that's really easy. Because when the laser is off, what is the Hamiltonian? It's just E times EE. So what you can do is you can just wait. And if you wait, you get, you know, a phase. So ground stays ground. And E goes to E to the minus I E T over H bar times itself. Okay? So you pick your time, you wait for that amount of time, and then you get a relative phase shift between the ground and excited. Okay? So that's, in some sense, that's really easy because you don't have to do anything. But you do have to keep track of time. And in fact, because this is happening whether you like it or not, when the laser is off, you're definitely going to have to keep track of time. You don't just keep track of time when you want to do a gate. You have to always keep track of time. But the idea is that by kind of putting your, so right now we're thinking about single qubit gates. So by putting your Rabi pulses at appropriate times, you can implement some sequence of these phase gates and these kind of Hadamard or other basis changing gates. And if you want to do arbitrary single qubit gates, well, so an arbitrary single qubit gate is some element of SU2, which, as you may recall, is up to double cover the same as SO3. So it's rotations in a sphere. And SO3, you remember, rotations have this Euler angle decomposition. So if you have any three-dimensional rotation, you can write it as three rotations around two axes. And that's what we have. We have rotations now around two axes. We have this phase gate and this one around a different axis. And so by doing, you know, one of these and then one of these and then one of these, we can get any single qubit gate. Okay? So there are questions on this. Okay, while you're thinking about that, let me confess that I actually kind of lied to you a bit. So if you just have one atom, this is pretty much fine. But suppose you have multiple atoms in the ion trap, which is the next thing we're going to do. So that one you can do by shining a laser just on one atom, right? And it will transition as I've described. But this one, well, you can't wait for different amounts of time for different atoms, right? Time is going to go at the same rate for all of them. And if you want to just do a phase gate on a single atom, you have to do something a little bit different. And the answer of what you want to do is, and the way it works is a little complicated, and I don't want to go into all the details. But I mean, it's not really that complicated, but the concepts behind it are a bit involved. But basically, these gates that you're doing are making some assumption about the phase of the laser. Okay, and you can adjust. You can get a phase shift here by fiddling with the phase of the laser. Okay, so if all the lasers that you're using on all the different atoms have kind of are phase locked, so they all have the same. The phases of the laser have to be controlled relative to each other. This is another kind of technical thing about these ion traps. If they're all kind of the same phase, then this will work this way on all the atoms. But if you change the phase of one of the lasers relative to the others, you can add a phase shift here. And that kind of absorbs your phase gates that you want to do. So that's really what you're doing when you do the single qubit gates, is you're kind of adjusting the phases of the lasers relative to each other.
So you mentioned earlier that because of time, you always have this rotation of the. Mm-hmm. So when you pulse the laser, you would expect actually the second part of your transformation to have this phase. But what you're saying is that you can.
Yes and no. So actually, So I forget exactly which approximations are brought into this. The easiest thing I could, well, yeah. So the thing is that when the laser is on, the system of the states ground plus laser state and excited plus laser state actually have the same energy, right? Because the laser has a frequency that's equal to this energy difference. So you know, when it absorbs a photon, there's kind of one extra or one less photon in the laser. So the energy is balanced, and that kind of cancels that phase. And so yes, it's there, but there's also there's also kind of a basis shift that's going on to get rid of it. This is part of the complication that I didn't want to talk about. But anyway, that's why, by adjusting the phase of the laser, you can adjust this phase shift. Basically, what's happening is there is a phase shift, but it gets canceled by the same phase shift that's happening in the laser. That's maybe an easier way to say it. Okay, any other questions? Okay. So before we move to two-qubit gates, let's talk briefly about how you measure a single state of the single electron, single ion trap. So to do this, we're going to use one of these additional states. So we're going to use a state F, which is very short-lived. And what I mean by short-lived is I mean that it will spontaneously decay back down to the ground state very fast. So we have a system like this. We have G here and E. These are our computational states. And up here somewhere, we have F. And F will rapidly decay back down to the ground state. So now, suppose I shine a laser on this that's resonant to this transition, the GF transition. Which is called a cycling transition. Well, what happens, first of all, the laser is very strong. We'll just go back and forth between G and F very rapidly with this sort of Rabi oscillation. But because F is very unstable, you know, sometimes F will not do stimulated emission back to ground state. It'll do spontaneous emission. And so it'll emit a photon. And we can see that photon, because the photon can be off in a different direction from the laser. And in fact, it won't emit just one photon, because it goes back down to the ground state, and the laser is still on. So we go back up to F, and back and forth and back and forth until it emits another photon. So it'll emit many photons, which are then easy to see, right? You can have photodetectors. Actually, you don't really even need anything very sensitive to see them, because you can get many, many photons this way. OK, but that's what happens if we start in the state G. We start in state G, we get photons. But E is non-resonant. So this laser is not doing anything to E. So E doesn't emit photons. It's dark. And therefore, we have a measurement, right? By literally looking, we can see whether we're in G or E. OK? That makes sense? And this procedure is actually very, very accurate. It can be done. The measurement is like, I don't know, 99.9% correct, something like that. Maybe more. So this is a very good realization of condition 5. But it also gives you a way to prepare qubits, right? Because suppose you have your atom, and it might be in E or it might be in G. You don't know offhand. But what do? You measure it. And then if it's in G, you're all set. It's in G. And if it's E, you just do a Rabi oscillation, a bit flip, and get it back down to the ground state. So this measurement technique also gives you condition 2, the ability to prepare all zero states. OK? Any questions on this? Yeah?
What determines whether the excited state is short-lived or stable?
Yeah, I don't know. So part of it is selection rules. So sometimes, I think that's usually a big factor, is that you can say that a single photon is not going to let you get from E to G. Which, of course, creates a problem with coupling them via this other laser. But sometimes you can do it by a pair of lasers. Sometimes you can have some other conservation rule that's just not going to be satisfied when you emit a photon. But you can still couple with the laser. I don't really know the full story. There's other things as well. I mean, so it could be. Yeah, I mean, so remember, these different energy levels also correspond to different spatial wave functions, different orbitals. And so the transitions between them are determined also by the overlap of those spatial wave functions, which, you know, this is not the hydrogen atom. It's a group two, and it could be, you know, a pretty heavy one. So they're not, they don't look exactly the same. Yeah, there's a lot, I think there's a lot of kind of atomic physics factors, which I really know nothing about, that determines other things. But basically, the people who do this kind of, they look at this atom, and they say, okay, we know what these energy levels are. We have a lot of information about what their properties are. And so we'll pick just the appropriate states that we want. And again, the other thing that's important is that you can have a good laser that transitions between these two, that has this frequency. Okay. Any questions? Hopefully ones that I can answer. Okay. So let's move on to the two-qubit case. So far, since we just had one atom in the ion trap, it didn't really matter kind of what shape the confining potential was in. Now we want to focus on a linear ion trap. So in two directions, it's a very strong confinement. In one direction, it's a weaker confinement. And that means that when we put multiple atoms in it, they'll tend to line up in a line. Okay, so it's very, very difficult for these atoms to move off in the transverse directions, but they can move back and forth in this direction relatively easily. But because they're all charged, positively charged, they'll repel each other. So they'll want to spread out in the trap like this. Okay, and moreover, when one of them moves, it will push the other ones away. And what we'll get, but of course, the trap is confining as well. So they can't just keep on going in one direction forever. They'll kind of hit the potential barriers in the trap and start to move back. And so what we're going to get is we're going to get oscillations if they start to move. So for instance, there's the center of mass mode, which is the one that we'll be talking about. We'll get normal modes, remember. So center of mass mode is the main one we'll be concerned about, where, you know, all of them move together like this. But of course, you also have the higher modes, such as the breathing mode, where they go out like this. You know, these two are going in opposite directions. This one, in that case, would stay put. And you know, all higher modes where they're going in different directions. And moreover, since these are single atoms, when we're talking about very low rates of motion, the process is quantized. So we have phonon modes. And for low amplitudes of oscillation, it's approximately the harmonic oscillator, just because, you know, everything is at lowest order. And so we have the phonon Hamiltonian, which is just h bar nu a dagger a. A is the annihilation operator for the phonon mode. Then if you look at, say, one atom and the phonon mode, we can kind of draw a joint energy diagram. So, all right, this state down here is the ground state of the atom and the ground state of the phonon, the vacuum. This state up here is the excited state of the atom and the vacuum for the phonon. But then we'll also have states like this, which are the ground state with one phonon and the excited state with one phonon. And states here with the ground state in two phonons and the excited state in two phonons, and so on. Okay? And of course, we have a bunch of different energy differences here. So this energy difference is E. And this energy difference here is h bar nu, the energy of one phonon. But what's particularly interesting is this energy difference, which I'm going to call H bar omega. So H bar omega is E minus H bar nu. Okay, and so this is and the idea is then if we shine a laser with frequency omega, so it induces a transition between, well, any state of the form En to a state of the form Gn plus 1. And back, of course. Okay? But the thing is that if we have the state G0, well, this would get coupled to E minus 1, which doesn't exist. So G0 doesn't get coupled to anything. It just stays by itself. Okay. And moreover, this phonon mode is shared by all the atoms. There's multiple phonon modes, but we're just concentrating on one of them, the center mass mode. And all of them interact with this same phonon mode. And so that's what we're going to use to interact the different atoms in the trap. We use these pulses, these kinds of pulses, this transition, to interact the electron state with the phonon state. And then we use the phonon state to interact with the state of a different electron in a different atom. Okay, so again, I'm gonna use a different state as kind of an intermediary. And so E prime, I don't want it to be unstable like F. It should be reasonably stable, but it doesn't have to be as long-lived or as stable under other kinds of fluctuations as the G and the E states, because we're not going to stay in it for very long. So let's see. So let's say it has energy E prime, and I'm going to let omega prime be this. So omega prime is the transition between E and E prime, but losing a phonon. So it's like that transition, but instead of between E and G, it's E and E prime. Yeah, I guess. Well, anyway. Okay. So then the two-qubit gate I'm going to show you is the Serac-Zoller gate. This was the first one that was proposed for the ion traps. It's kind of conceptually the simplest. In the tutorial tomorrow, you're going to kind of work out how a different gate works. That's a bit more popular nowadays. So it's basically a three-step process. So first, we do a pi over 2 pulse on ion 1. With frequency omega, which is, remember, E minus E over H bar minus nu. So I could say that I want to start with the phonon in the vacuum of the phonon, the zero state. And I'm going to use a subscript p to indicate the phonon, and the subscripts 1 and 2 to indicate ions 1 and 2. So what we're doing here, since we're doing this frequency omega pulse on ion 1, if we have we're starting with the phonon in 0. So we have one of these two states, G0 or E0. And if we have E, well, this is giving us that transition up there. So E0 will go to G1. And we're doing a pi over 2 pulse. So we're basically flipping between those two things in the transition. So E0 goes to G1. But G0, as I said, doesn't couple to anything here. So it stays G0. And you'll notice that these two states are still orthogonal. So this is a perfectly good unitary operation. But we've kind of moved the information from the atom into the phonon. OK, so the next step is we're going to do a pi pulse on ion 2 with frequency omega prime. Okay, and so omega prime is doing this transition between E and E prime. So it's not going to do anything. So let's consider the possibilities here. So now we only care about atom 2. So we're going to look at G2. And E2, but the phonon could be 0 or it could be 1. So we actually have four states that we care about here. So if atom 2 is in, G, nothing happens. This will definitely not couple to it, regardless of the phonon mode. So we stay where we are. And if the atom is E but is in 0, well, this can only do the E. It's not resonant to the EE prime transition. It's EE prime minus a phonon. And so if the phonon is in the 0 mode, we can't take out a phonon to make up that energy difference. So this also doesn't do anything. But in this case, we can take out a phonon. And so we can transition between E1 and E prime 0. But of course, this is a pi pulse. So remember, the pi pulse just brings us back to where we started, but with a minus 1 phase. And now it's not a global phase anymore, because it's only happening on one of the, out of these four states. So we get here minus E2, 1. OK? And then step 3 is we're going to undo step 1. Which basically is another pi over 2 pulse, but there's an issue about the phases. So what do we do? Well, now step 1 transitioned the information from atom 1 into the phonon. So step 3 is moving it back into atom 1. So we end up with the same basis state that we started with before. But along the way, we've gotten a phase shift if and only if we had this particular combination. And how do we get this combination? Well, the only way to get it is if we had E in the first ion. Right? That's how we get 1 in the phonon. And we also need, of course, an E in the second ion. Otherwise, we're here, which has no phase. And so the overall effect is a phase gate, controlled phase gate. So So if we have any of these three states, we end up back where we started. If we started with the EE gate, we got minus EE. So if you write this as a matrix, it's just this diagonal matrix, 1, 1, 1, minus 1. Okay? So that's definitely a 2-qubit gate. And it turns out that up to local unitaries, single-qubit unitaries, it's equivalent to the CNOT gate. And you're going to do that in the tutorial to figure out exactly how to do this. But in particular, what I care about now is that this, in conjunction with the single-qubit gates, form a universal set of gates. And so that's condition, which condition was it? 4. Okay? So, right. So back here, I guess I had condition 1. I didn't even mention it. That's our qubits. And then we have 2 over here, although actually I have to update you on that. And then we have 3 somewhere. Oh, yes. Low decoherence rates, condition 3. And then this is 4, and then we have 5. So we have all the DiVincenzo criteria. Okay. But actually, like I said, I have to update you on condition 2. Why is that? Well, certainly we can use the same technique when we have multiple atoms to individually put all the atoms into the ground state. Oh, wow, I'm running out of time. Okay. To individually put all of the atoms into the ground state. But the problem is that in order to do this gate, we also needed the phonon in the ground state. And that's a little harder to do. But we can do it by looking at this picture again and looking at these transitions. Okay, so suppose let's first put all of the atoms in the ground state. Okay, but the phonon might be in some excited state. So how do we get rid of the excitations of the phonon? Well, suppose we, on one of the atoms, shine something with, let's do a pi over 2 pulse with frequency omega. So if we're here, we're going to go to here. If we're here, we're going to go to here. If we're here, we're going to go to here, and so on. So what we're going to do is we're going to take one phonon out of the laser, but the atom is going to go into the excited state. But we know how to cool that single atom, right? We can, well, the thing is we don't know how many phonons there were in. There might have been 0 phonons, so this atom could still be in G. So what we should do is we should measure that single atom to see whether it's G or not. And if it's excited, then we can push it back down to the ground state. But in the process, we never got back that phonon that we took out before. So now we've gone from here to here, or from here to here, or whatever. And so you can keep repeating that process to kind of step down this ladder and get back to the G0. So that's called sideband cooling. Okay, so one other big complication in the ion trap. I mean, I said I satisfied condition 1 because I have well-characterized qubits, but it's not exactly a scalable system. So why is that? Well, I can put multiple ions in a single trap, but there's a limit to how many I can put in a trap. Why is that? Well, it's a bunch of trade-offs. So for instance, if you keep the trap the same and put more and more ions in, they're going to get closer and closer together. And so for one thing, this creates a problem that they can start to interact with each other. For another, it gets hard to shine lasers on individual atoms and control them. Because when you do, you're likely to have some light that's shining on the adjacent atoms. Okay? So you don't really want them to get too close together. On the other hand, if you make the trapping potential weaker so that they can spread out more, then your phonon mode is going to get weaker, the frequency will go down, and the distance between phonon modes will go down. And that's definitely harder to work with. And moreover, the different phonon modes, you get many, many phonon modes with many, many atoms. And they'll start to interfere with each other and get in the way as well. So in practice, if you want this level of control, it's unlikely you could ever do that beyond, you know, roughly 50 qubits. So if you really want to make a big quantum computer this way, you have to have some way of putting these things together. Okay, let me just draw a couple of pictures about how you do this. So one way is to physically move your ions around. So you're going to have a kind of a multi-section trap. So for instance, one geometry you might think of is something like this, for a small example. And you can store ions in these corners here. And then when you're ready to interact, you move them into the center section. And so you have, you know, you're going to have lots of different electrodes here that let you, you know, turn the magnetic fields on and off and put on the trapping potentials and move these atoms around. And then once they're together like this, you can do a gate between them, and then you move them back. Okay, and move some other pair of atoms into the middle there. Okay. And people have kind of demonstrated the basic components of this technique. So that's one approach. And so another approach is to put together multiple ion traps. So you're going to have two separate ion traps, or many separate ion ones. But we're going to put them in optical cavities. And so what that means is that the ion trap, as well as having a phonon mode, also has a photon mode that's trapped in it. But it's not going to be perfectly trapped. And occasionally, the photon can leak out. Okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to say, OK, let's try to get it to leak out. If it does leak out, so you know, the optical cavity basically has two mirrors, really, 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 really good mirrors, a very precise distance apart. But if this one is slightly worse than this one, then the photon is more likely to leak out this way. Okay? And so by doing this, we can put it into an optical fiber, and we can take this one and put if it leaks out into an optical fiber. And then we put them through a beam splitter. Okay? And if we measure and we see a photon here, we don't actually know which cavity it came from. Right? And so in fact, because kind of the probability, these two cavities are the same, so the probability of having it leak out of either one is the same. It's actually a quantum mechanical process, the leaking out. And so what we get is we get an entangled state, an EPR pair, between the photon modes in these two cavities. Okay? And you can interact the photon mode with the state of the electron, the ions that are trapped in these cavities, using basically the same procedure. Just replace the word phonon over there with photon. And so you can transition this to an EPR pair between atoms in two different traps. And once you have that, you can use teleportation. To move your qubits around. You're not actually moving the atoms this time. You're just moving the quantum information from one trap to another. And then once you know, you can teleport the two qubits that you want to interact into the same trap, you'd use some gate, and then you can teleport them back if you want. Okay? So this is an example of how teleportation can be a useful procedure just for building a quantum computer. Okay, so I guess I need to stop there because we're over time. But are there questions? Okay, so then tomorrow we're going to talk about superconducting qubits. And I guess the tutorial is Friday afternoon this week.